history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, if you take the initiative, you're going to find some pretty incredible stories there just waiting to be told. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we end up gaining so much. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. As I wait for the end of our sheltering in place to allow me to visit veterans in person again, we've been marking 75th anniversaries here on Hometown Heroes. This weekend marks an anniversary of a different number, and I'm sure you'll see a few mentions of it on the news this weekend, but 78 years ago, on April 18th, 1942, the daring Doolittle raid on Tokyo saw 16 B-25s take off of the deck of the USS Hornet for their one-way mission that would shock Imperial Japan and stir the spirits of Americans back home. This is only the second year that this anniversary has arrived with none of those Doolittle raiders still alive. What a legacy they have, one we've heard about from several who were there to watch or participate over the years. But today's program is going to focus on a different legacy, and what an incredible legacy it is. On Friday, April 10th, Good Friday, Dr. Fitzalbert Marius passed away at the age of 98. In addition to performing more than 11,000 heart surgeries, Dr. Marius was a gifted artist, poet, musician, tailor, author, and teacher who never, I mean never, ever slowed down. In fact, the last thing he did before passing in his sleep was prepare for a Bible study he was to lead via video chat the next day. We're going to hear his remarkable life story today, starting with an answer he always had ready because so many were so amazed by how many different disciplines he was able to excel in and how tireless he was in finding ways to contribute to the betterment of others.
Well, the point is, I just simply have priorities and I don't waste any time at all.
I guess not.
I take care of things, and people always ask me, God dog, Bert, how did you have time to do all this stuff? I say, I just don't waste the time. I use it effectively and efficiently. I wasn't quite 3 years old when we immigrated from Panama to Harlem, New York. The first memory I have is living in that first apartment building near 137th Street at 8th Avenue. We lived up on the sixth floor, and it was a very, very interesting situation because they were called railroad apartments in those times, and the railroad apartments don't have any hallways. Each room goes from one room to another, so you had to learn to respect each other. And on top of that, there were two apartments on each floor, but only one bathroom in the hallway for both apartments. So you had to learn to live with other people with respect. And it had an influence on the attitude that I developed. My mother and my father were both born in St. Lucia, which was a former French-speaking island, but it was owned now by the British. You know, it was one, part of the British West Indies. And it was a French-speaking island. So I grew up speaking French and English. And how I was born in Panama was my father, when he got married to get a job, he worked for the Panama Canal Zone. And so just the first two of us, my older brother Hugh, was born in Panama City at one side of the Panama Canal, and I was born in Colon, Panama, on the other side. But we didn't know it until World War II, but we were born citizens. Because we were born in a territory owned by the United States, but we didn't know it. Mm-hmm. My main ambition had always been this, to be another Rembrandt or Leonardo da Vinci. I never wanted to go into medicine or nothing else. I wanted to be a Rembrandt because my means of communicating my attitude and thoughts and feelings was in art, writing, poetry. So I didn't know how to speak to people, to communicate, I'd get down and write a poem, or I'd paint a picture. And that way I'd learn, and that's way the Lord had blessed me with that talent and line. And then what happened was when I went to Frederick Douglass Junior High School on 143rd Street between Lenox and 7th Avenue at that time. County Cullen, one of the Harlem Renaissance poets, was my teacher. He was my teacher in French and English. And County Cullen, you know, encouraged me to continue in art, you know, because naturally he was an art himself. That's all down the line. After I graduated there, and I went to Stuyvesant High School, and Stuyvesant High School at that time was one of the number one scientific high schools in the whole United States. And you had to pass a specific test to pass it. And obviously, I was a good student, you know, because I was persevering and what you call it, and I did a lot of research and a lot of reading and so on down the line. So I went to Stuyvesant High School, and I was one of the few blacks there. When I graduated from Stuyvesant, I was 17 years old, and I'd received a scholarship to Pratt Institute, which is an art institute in Brooklyn, New York. And I went there for about a month. I didn't like what they were doing and stuff, so I left and I did some studying at the Art Students League in New York. Then after that, I spent 9 months in Greenwich Village with a buddy of mine, you know, and that was during the Depression. Of course, it's $10 a month, and most months we couldn't raise the $10. But we ate because there was a Village Vanguard down there, which is still in existence today. And the Village Vanguard was started in about 1938 by an Italian guy who wanted to create this nightclub to promote music, you know, jazz music and poetry and writings and stuff like that. And we talked, and they used to have jam sessions there. So Count Basie and Jimmy Lunsford and all those, Ella Fitzgerald and all those people used to come down after they'd finished from about 2 to 4, and they'd have jam sessions. And I met all those musicians down there, and me and my buddy would sit down, and as they played the jam session, we would write the poetry, and we'd get up and recite it to the music, because they're playing blues or something, you know. There was a girl who came to me last night, you know, boom ba doo ba doo ba doo ba doo ba doo, and then we would recite the thing. Yes, we walked down the street with this girl you need, and torn down the line, and so on. And we recite the poems, and we don't know how many of those poems they used and stuff down there. But that's how he fed us. Uh-huh. And that's how we ate. But that's all I wanted to do.
Well, and a lot of questions come to mind. It almost sounds like you're a pioneer of rap by doing that with the poetry, with the beat going behind you. A little different beat,
but
maybe.
It wasn't rap, you know. It wasn't rap at all. It was pure poetry, and we recited it. We didn't sing it. Instead of the music, we just simply recited the poem, right. You know. Yeah. Right.
And I didn't mean to denigrate your poetry by comparing it to hip-hop.
No, there's some of the rap that has good, what you call it, you know, but most of it I don't understand a thing.
Well, I know one thing you do understand, probably as very few others do, the racial situation in this country. Mm-hmm. I'm curious for you, in those days, before World War II, how did you view that situation? Did you see discrimination and bias? Did you experience that yourself? Was that something that was out of sight, out of mind? What was your view of it then?
Well, you see, we didn't have all of the sidetracks and social nuances that's associated with it. We dealt with the reality. Now, there was no doubt in the mind of blacks that there was prejudice and discrimination. You were limited to certain things you could do. Blacks could not go into architecture because you couldn't make a living. There were very few scholarships available. You couldn't get into most white schools. If you didn't have a job as a janitor or anything like that, there was no such thing as a black being a bank clerk or clerk or none of that kind of stuff. Teachers were restricted to black areas for teaching and so on down the line. You know where you stood. So you knew you had to move from the bottom up. And there's one good thing that you knew this. You could not depend on the government because the government was controlled by the whites. And at least when you were in Mississippi or Georgia and that stuff, you knew exactly how you should act and what you should deal with. When you walk down the streets, when I had visited various places like that, you learn. A white man's coming down the street this way and you come in that way, you stepped off the curve and let him pass. You also learned you never looked in that area a white woman in the eye because they had a blue law, and it was blue law called eyeball rape. If you looked a white woman in the eye, she could call the cop and call you, they arrest your butt, put you in jail, and arrest you for eyeball rape. And many blacks never got out of that jail. They committed suicide, they said.
And you knew of actual instances where that happened?
Yes. I knew of instances where that happened. All right. So you learn a whole lot of stuff. The young people, blacks, they have no concept of all of what discrimination was. They think they're being discriminated, but they're not utilizing what they have. As I pointed out to them, I said, now, the whole issue is my family had five boys and one girl. All right. And one girl, she got in there because she was a twin, or else she wouldn't have made it. But the top was, all five boys in my family, and I tell this to the students at school when they ask, you know, how can you make it if you don't have income to pay for college? My people had no money, you know, they're just living from week to week and so on and on. My mother got paid 25 cents an hour for working as cleaning up people's houses. She just worked a few hours here and a few hours there. And my father was making $7 a week. But we managed to make it. So they had no money to pay for our tuition and go on the line. But we helped each other. My older brother, to tell people, even without any help and so on down the line, and helping yourself and the inspiration and the drive of your family and so on down the line, you can still make it. My older brother wound up with 3 degrees. He wound up with a BA from City College, a master's from New York University, and a PhD in political science from Université de Paris in France. He wound up being not only a politician, but he wound up speaking 8 languages fluently. He was very familiar in his politics with Bill Clinton and other kinds of people. He was on the line. He was the associate commissioner of markets in New York City. He was commissioner of environs and commissioner of something else. And he also wound up to being the director of the Commission of Alcoholic Beverages of the state of New York. Now, when he finished, he helped me. I wound up in medicine and so on down the line in art and various other kinds of things. We both went and helped the brother under me, and he wound up with a master's in civil engineering. The brother under him wound up with a master's in biochemistry. My youngest brother wound up with not only a master's in electrical engineering, which he worked for one of the biggest companies and the best, strongest companies there for about 2 years, decided that's not what he wanted to do, went back to medical school, and became an internal medical doctor. And we all did that helping each other, not with scholarships or anything else.
And I guess the question is, because you know how unique that is, mm-hmm. and how extremely impressive that is, but rare, and if it were that easy, everybody would do it, right? So what was the secret? Why do you think that happened in your family as opposed to other families?
Well, it's not just my family, but remember, it was the attitude and heart of the people helping each other. We weren't thinking only of me, myself, and I. We were thinking of us. And we knew how to help each other and knew that you had to be productive. You could not have an attitude of entitlement simply because your butt woke up in the morning. You were entitled to the opportunity to seek employment, but you weren't entitled to the product of the employment without working. And you knew that from the beginning. So that's how we we got into that, and that's what helped me all the way through college and everything else that I did. Those were days, you know, that was different than today, you know, because blacks had to do things that it was very easy for you to be the first black that. Because black didn't have very many opportunities.
Well, that's one way to look at it, as an opportunity, when most looked at it as a brick wall that was impenetrable. Mm-hmm. But what you guys did in World War II played such a role in those color barriers falling in sports and in culture afterwards. You mentioned the fireside chats with FDR.
Yeah.
So what about Pearl Harbor? Is that how you heard about that too? Was it from FDR?
Well, now, there's how I wound up in the Army on December 7th, 1941. I can still see that in my mind. I was at Lincoln University. I started Lincoln University in 1940. And I was sitting there, and I was not going to Lincoln University majoring in pre-med. When I went to Lincoln University, I majored in architecture because it was associated with art. And so, you know, a lot of people, because here when I got in Fresno and went into general surgery and wound up with Frank DeBakey in San Francisco, that's when Stanford Lane was up in San Francisco before it moved to Ann Arbor in the days of the dinosaur. So I was in on the early things concerning the modern-day heart surgery, you know, as we're known, and heart transplants and all those sort of things. But, you know, the whole point is how I got into medicine. Well, back there, after, you know, he gave that talk and said that we are now at war with Japan. We're involved in the war. It wasn't a shock to me because the whole issue was, at that time, we were isolating ourselves. We should have been involved against Hitler and stuff, along with France and Great Britain and stuff, but we isolated ourselves. That's their problem. And so the only way we got involved in World War II was when Japan chose to attack Hawaii. So anyway, what happened? At the time, one of the guys came over to me and said, now, they got an ASTP program associated with this, and that program is a different kind of program because there's a lack of certain kind of specialties in the Army. And they've put together a special program for people who are in pre-med. Instead of you going 4 years through pre-med, what they now in that new ASTP program have is that after 2 years of pre-med, they take you out of the pre-med and they put you through a concentrated 2 years of medical school. And in 4 years, you are MD instead of 8. Now, I got to thinking, now I'm working all summer, and then doing while I'm at school, in order to eat, I'm washing dishes in the kitchen. And I said, now, I don't have to do this another 2 years if I join this program. And plus that, they'll pay for my medical school. So I moved and became pre-med, and that's how I got into medicine.
So many of his patients over the years were thankful he did. So the war turned his path toward medicine, but that path was not as direct as he expected, especially after a detour born out of mistaken racial identity. I've never heard a story quite like that of Dr. Fitzalbert Marius, and you'll hear some of the most eye-opening parts of it when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I've found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538 800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special tribute this week to a World War II veteran who left a lasting impression wherever he went. After featuring Dr. Fitzalbert Marius here on the radio a couple of years ago, I had the privilege of accompanying him to quite a few speaking engagements. And whether he was talking to teenagers, to fellow World War II vets, or to any age group in between, I got to witness firsthand his incredible ability to connect, to entertain, and ultimately to challenge all of us to be the best we can be. Dr. Marius passed away on April 10th at the age of 98. You can access his original two-part interview at hometownheroesradio.com. But we'll pick up his story with his joining the Army Specialized Training Program because of the accelerated path toward a career in medicine it represented.
That was in December 1942. I joined, enlisted in the Army under that thing. At the end of my second year, they took me out of there and came down at Oxford, Pennsylvania, and picked us, all of us who had joined that program, and took us up to Fort Dix, New Jersey, where we would be interviewed. So I wound up at Fort Dix, and now this is very, very interesting, and if it hadn't happened to me, because as you know, back in that time, the Army was absolutely segregated. No blacks could be in a white part of the Army, and on top of that, very few black officers. The officers over most of the black units were white officers who did not meet the qualifications to be over the white units. And they became the lieutenant and the captain over your units, like they were over mine. And they had certain kinds of things, myths and so on, during that period of time. Like, during that period of time, you only had four races. It's not like today, you know, with the multiplicity of stuff that they have. The four races: white, colored, yellow, and red. And you had to fall in one of those four categories. And there were no other categories you fell into. So, and blacks, of course, fell under colored. So I wound up there, I remember, going in for my interview. And they also had, there was a myth among the whites at that time that you did not look a black male directly in the eye all for any long periods of time, because if you do, it was just like walking on the ladder or black cat crossing or being on the 13th floor.
Oh boy.
So they didn't look at you. Uh-huh. So when I went in, this white lieutenant was sitting on the other side, and I went in and stood up at attention, you know, and he says, not looking up at all, he's looking down at the paper, and didn't look up at me the whole interview, and says, relax, soldier, sit down. So I sat down, and I'm looking, but he never looked at me. And he began asking the usual questions, says, name, Fitzalbert Michael Marius. Now, that ain't a name like Jim Brown. And on top of that, I had a New York accent with some inflections of the West Indian accent in it. Sure. At that time. So I didn't say y'all, yes, boss, you know, none of that stuff. So I didn't have nothing Southern, nothing sounded like a colored man. And a name, Fitzalbert M. Marius? All right. Place of birth, Colon, Panama, not Biloxi, Mississippi. He went on down the line as education. 2 years of college. Now, most blacks at that time was lucky to make it to the fifth grade. And he just went on and on and on and on. And then he got way down to the, what you call it, do you speak any other language besides English? And I said, yes, sir, I speak French. Because I grew up speaking French. Now, none of these characteristics match anything colored. These characteristics are written down there are the characteristics you find associated with an intelligent white man. So after a while, he looked at the paper, and then he looked up for the first time, and you could see this, his eyes open wide, because what he saw did not match what was on the paper. So he said to me, he says, soldier, private, are you colored? And at that time, I was not very, you know, I didn't have the insight that I have now. If I'd have simply said yes, I'd have gotten into the program. But instead of that, I said, what do you think? And he looked at me and looked at the paper several times. And then he took out something and he wrote something on the paper and it says, soldier, you're discharged. You may leave. And I left. And the next morning, I was the only person of the group that received an order to get on a train to head for Denver, Colorado, at Fitzsimmons General Hospital. So naturally, I'm a soldier, I obeyed it. And I got all the way to Denver, Colorado, got to Fitzsimmons General Hospital, and it was a base about 1,600 to about 2,000 men. And I was the only individual on that base this color. Everybody else on that base was white. It was a 2.5 to 3 month program where they trained you to work with doctors on the field, you know, as a doctor's assistant, a nurse, you know, and so on down the line. So they put me in the barrack, and I was on the upper bunk, the top of the bed, and at the bottom bed was a young white guy from Georgia, and his father was the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan.
Now you got to be kidding me. I mean, all of this is hard to believe, but that one, I mean, what are the odds of that?
Yeah, well, the odds of this is, and like I said, if I hadn't experienced it myself, it would be hard to believe, with the Army segregated. So the whole time that I was there, the 2.5 to almost 3 months, I slept with the one eye open because they verbally abused me every opportunity you get. I can't tell you the things they called me. And whenever they got an opportunity, they physically kicked my butt. But just about a week or so before the time was concluded, six of them caught me off to the side by myself, beat my butt up really bad, and then grabbed me by the feet and had me hanging upside down, dipping my head into a barrel of oil where they were going to drown me. And fortunately, a captain came by. And naturally, you know, captain has to follow his orders and not allow any soldier to harm another soldier regardless, you know. So brought no charges against them at all. But anyway, after I left there, I went to Camp Barkley, Texas, which is outside of Dallas. And it was the first time, you know, I didn't know, you know, how did I wind up here in this situation? And naturally, the captain was a white captain, and he was also from Georgia, you know, and he was, then I'm standing at attention, and he's looking at the record, and he just fell out laughing. And naturally, I never changed the expression on my face because you learn as a soldier, you know, how to act, you know. And I just stood there watching. And then finally, after he laughed a while, he reached and got a big, long stamp, which was about 8 inches. And then he stamped right across the middle of the document, colored. And I said, oh, my God. This stupid lieutenant had put down there that I was white. And that's how I wound up in Denver, Colorado, because what he probably said to himself was this. Now, this guy was born in Colon, Panama. Now, he's of dark skin, but he speaks a different language, and no color, none of these characteristics meets colored. If I'm going to make a mistake, I would much rather make the mistake the other way around than putting a white man with blacks. So when the Army was completely segregated, Fitz Albert M. Marius, for almost 3 months, was white. But it almost got me killed. It was the worst 3 months that I've ever spent in my whole life.
And I've got to ask you, I mean, you tell the story so well in such captivating fashion, and I don't think you left anything out, but I'm just imagining you, as you described, six guys have grabbed you, so obviously fighting back is futile. They've got you outnumbered. They've overpowered you.
Yeah.
And they're hanging you by your ankles, dipping your face into a barrel of oil. So what's going through your mind as that is happening?
I'm getting killed. That's what's going through my mind.
Yeah.
That's all that's happening. I'm not thinking of nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking I ain't going to make it.
How close do you think you came to being killed right there? I mean, how much longer would it have taken if that guy, the captain, didn't come by?
I don't know. You know, I have no idea of knowing. All I can remember is they were killing my butt, and fortunately the captain came by and my life was saved. Now, little details about how many minutes it was, none of that made any effect on me. The major aspect was my life was saved. Mm-hmm. And that's all I can remember. Yeah.
And every veteran I've talked to, it seems like, has at least one moment where his life was spared. Most of those, though, are in the war, not here in the States before you ever got to war, because of this extreme case of mistaken identity that I guess really underscores, not to get up on a soapbox and not to be master of the obvious, but doesn't that underscore the fallacy and erroneous idea that these racist thoughts originate from? I mean, doesn't it expose how stupid racism is?
Of course it does. Of course it does. But it does not change the sociological and social system. Your social system changes from the heart, not from the intellect. You see, you can make all the laws you want. It will not change the way a person feels. They'll work around the laws. I mean, I found I did the same kind of stuff myself, working around the law. Now, before I gave myself over to Christ in 1967, I lived a life of what I would have called integrity, because I was always an honest man. I didn't lie. I told the truth. If I made a commitment, I kept it. Now, the commitment may not have been the right thing to do, but I kept it anyway, because I was a man of my oath. My mother told me, Bertie, don't you ever make an oath you don't keep. You hear that, boy? And I can still hear her now telling me that. So I kept those kind of oaths. I didn't go out. I was raised Catholic. So marriage meant one woman, one time and stuff. So I wasn't out running after a whole bunch of other women or none of that kind of stuff. But I was just following orders. It was no change of heart involved. And that only occurred after I accepted Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior in 1967, in March the 3rd. And I remember that date very specifically because it was 2 days after my birthday, March the 1st. Mm-hmm. But that's where the difference came, remembering and having a change of heart. You see, not an intellectual attitude, but a change of heart. So anyway, when I wound up in the South Pacific and in all those areas you read about, Guadalcanal and Bougainville and all those places, I was there. Yeah.
Well, and let's talk about how you ended up there. So they, you know, so we don't lose a segment of the story here. You're in Denver. You almost are killed. They figure out this paper's wrong. He's clearly not Caucasian. Mm-hmm. They put that big colored stamp on your file.
That's when I went to Camp Barkley, Texas, and went through basic training.
With other African-American troops?
Of course. It was. I was black again. I was one among the white folks no longer.
How was that different, being with an all-black unit and going through basic training with all black soldiers all of a sudden after the time you'd spent surrounded by nothing but white soldiers?
Well, the number one thing, I was not concerned. I could sleep with both eyes closed. and nobody was going to cuss me out because I was black. They had other reasons too, which they did later on, but not because I was black. After the basic training, which took about 3 months, they shipped us up to a camp in Pennsylvania. And then after we left there, then they shipped us down to an area right outside of Stockton, California, and they boarded us on a ship. We went from there, first landed in Hawaii. I finally wound up in New Caledonia, and New Caledonia is a French-influenced area, and it was very interesting because the United States of America had an armed depot there, you know, that they collected things and then so on down the line. But they needed, you know, translators. And, of course, they looked at my record, and even though the Army was segregated, you know, I spoke French, so they put me in there to be as an interpreter to the people who in that area who were working there who spoke French. Now, the other interpreter who was there was a white lieutenant from Mississippi. As a matter of fact, he happened to be teaching language, and French was one of the languages he taught in the University of Mississippi. But he grew up in Mississippi. He had, of course, a Mississippian accent. So even when he spoke French, you heard the Mississippi accent in it. Huh. Like, if you want to say, do you want something to eat in French? Say, est-ce que vous voulez quelque chose pour manger maintenant? Okay, you want something to eat right now. Well, he said, in his French southern accent, est-ce que vous voulez chose pour manger maintenant? First time I've ever heard French spoken with a southern accent. And they couldn't understand him. And they would turn to me and say, qu'est-ce qu'il dit? What did he say? But I had to be very careful. I had to whisper to them in French, I'll explain to you later, because I didn't want to explain nothing in front of him. After, you know, he'd finished and told him all he wanted to do, then I would go off someplace and they'd follow me, and then I would tell them in French that they could understand. But I knew better to embarrass him. Because
sure.
He was a lieutenant, and I was nothing but a private. Mm-hmm. So anyway, after that is when we moved to places like Guadalcanal and all that sort of stuff, and there were all kinds of experiences. And since we had medical associated with us, they did not arm us.
And let's explain that for people listening. So you're an all-black unit. Mm-hmm. That is in the Pacific, and you're following along with the 1st Marine Division. You're attached to the 1st Marine Division. But what was your job? What were you guys supposed to come in and do?
All we're supposed to do was to take care of all of these things like disease, insects, and stuff like that. If there were some certain flies and stuff, we were to get rid of them. We had the stuff to spray, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Dig the ditches, to drain the swamps, you know, and all that sort of stuff. That's what we did. And then of course, when things happened, to bury the dead. Now, what happened, as a matter of fact, it was in Iwo Jima. When we were going in the invasion of Iwo Jima, they had the two units. So one had to go in because there were certain insects and flies and stuff and that carried a certain amount of certain diseases and stuff that they had to go in to take care of. So they flipped a coin to decide which unit would go in. No, it was a straw, the short straw and the long straw.
All right.
So we'd pick the right straw. So they had to go in first with the 1st Marine Division. And there in Iwo Jima, they had caves up there, and the Japanese had the guns and all that stuff on tracks. They pulled them back into the cave. So even though they bombed all the areas and stuff like that before they sent the troops in, they had all the major troops and stuff all back there because there was an airport there that the United States wanted to control and take over. But anyway, when they first sent the 1st Marines in, they also sent the 727 because the 727 lost and they went in. Now, there's 125 people belonging to each one of those groups. Only three of them made it back. All the rest of them got killed. Now, if we had gone in first, we would have only had three left.
Yeah.
So the Lord was looking out after me and that group. So, and a lot of things happened like that. And at Guadalcanal, almost got wiped out at Guadalcanal because there, the Japanese at that time, you know, had their planes, and we didn't have the fast planes to keep up with them at that time. And they hadn't just put them out yet. And so they would come in and they would bomb the heck out of the areas. And we were in foxholes and they bombed us for 2 weeks and stuff like that. And all kinds of people got killed and so on. But I made it through. And as a matter of fact, the Lord blessed the heck out of me because the whole 3 years or so that I was over in that South Pacific, I did not get one disease. As many anopheles mosquitoes as I got bitten with, I never got malaria. I never got any of those other diseases. All those other people got shot all around me, and I never got one injury. The Lord was looking out for Bert Marius because I wasn't looking out for myself.
I'm sure I'm not the only one who knew Dr. Bert Marius who's going to miss that characteristic laugh as much as anything. He beat the odds and made it through World War II, but not without some close calls. And we'll hear about that when this special tribute edition of Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to remember trailblazing heart surgeon and one of the nearly 1 million African Americans who served our country in uniform in World War II, Dr. Fitzalbert Marius, who passed away April 10th at the age of 98. He served with the 725th Medical Sanitation Company, a segregated unit that followed the 1st Marine Division throughout the Pacific.
Now, World War II was about the end of true world wars, true war. In World War II, the people you fought against was your enemy. Your job was to kill all of them or get killed and control all of them or be controlled. Not like today, where they go into these various places, allow them to continue to operate and help them trying to operate the right way. So until you got the Japanese controlled, so we understood that. Those were our enemies. Whatever they did, we suspect they were trying to get rid of us, so we got rid of them first. They were the enemy. We had some problems with our country, but they were the major enemy. And we weren't over there to solve prejudice. We were over there to take care of the enemy that had attacked America. And we understood you could not solve the problem in the United States of America if the Japanese controlled America. Right. So we had to get rid of that enemy first, and that's where we focused. So we didn't have the kind of attitude, well, I'm not going to work hard to do what is right to save America and hold up the American flag because they ain't treating us right. No, we didn't have that kind of attitude, you know. It's like I tell people, say, we grew up understanding life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Not like you young people today. Life, liberty, and happiness without pursuit. Just go out. Just simply because you woke up in the morning, you're entitled to everything I got. You're entitled to produce or have the opportunity to produce. But you're not entitled to the product. But that's how they feel today. I never expected to be able to return back to the United States of America. My attitude was, I am most likely going to die over in the South Pacific. So I did everything to keep me alive every day. But I never expected to get back home.
And what would you say were the times you look back on now as the close calls, as the closest you came to not coming home?
Well, one of the closest was when we hit Cebu City. We were on the ship, and we were not supposed to leave the ship because there were snipers in the city. But a group of us got together and said, Lord, you know, we've been all this time in the South Pacific and stuff, and of course, you know, the inhabitants were moved away, and we never ran across any women or anything like that, you know, and so on down the line, except, you know, nurses and stuff in the army. So, man, you know, if we get into Cebu City, we might find some nice women we can work with. So what we did, we volunteered to help take some of the things off the ship, you know, down to the port. And, of course, what we had planned is once we got down on the port, we would take off to Cebu City. So we were there sitting down in this square in Cebu City. We were there, and we're drinking our booze and talking about, you know, where we're going to go to hunt up the women. And all of a sudden, the snipers opened on us. And this guy named Arthur was sitting next to me. Now, I'm here, and you, Arthur, there, and I'm looking him in the eye. And the snipers opened up, and a bullet hit him right in the middle of the forehead and killed him right there with me looking dead at him. Anyway, the rest of us, there were eight of us, we all ducked down and stuff, and we got away from there and returned. Now, we had to report the death. So we reported the death and of course, had to be honest and tell the captain, you know, how we managed to get there in the first place. He didn't put us in the brig, but what he did was this. He turned to me, because I was a corporal at the time, and he said, "Corporal Marius, you are now responsible for alerting his parents of his death." And he put that ethos on me. And it was a tough one because he wouldn't have died if it hadn't been us talking him into doing that. So that was one of the closest, you know, because I came across a lot of other things like, you know, bombs and stuff like that and rockets and things like that. But I was very, very fortunate. I didn't get not one injury the whole time. God was looking out for me.
And how hard was that to write that letter to his family?
Oh, man, it was really tough. I would have rather he stuck me in the brig than having to take that accountability. Yeah. Woo! Because, you know, when you're feeling guilty about your accountability and that and responsibility in that situation, and now you got to face a mother that you feel is you happen to be partly responsible for the death of her son. Oh, man, that was heavy on my butt.
And just hearing you talk about everything else and hearing you process the things that your remarkable life taught you, why do I have a feeling that incident, that scenario, that real unfortunate incident taught you something?
Oh, naturally it taught me something. You know, let's face it, a lot of the things that you learn comes from the hard mistakes that you made. It's things like, for instance, Dr. Lowe, you know, in cardiac surgery, when you put into the aorta, the major thing that you pump the blood back into the patient, you know, from the heart-lung machine. So it's a hole that you put a purse string around and you tie it off and stuff like that. But then you have a small hole, which is kind of a needle hole, where you put a special good-sized needle where you clamp off the difference between that, and that's the one that you feed in the cold thing to stop the heart so that you can work on it. Now, Dr. Lowe, everybody else, when they take this one out, they tie it and then they put extra stitches and maybe sometime even a patch across it because it's a decent hole. But the little string that comes out that little needle hole, they just tie that off. Dr. Lowe, on the other hand, he treats the other one, you know, routinely, but he puts extra stitches and a patch across the needle hole that comes out. If you didn't know, now I was there when the incident occurred at Children's Hospital, so I know why he did it. He did it because one day that needle hole thing broke and the blood started pumping out of there, and we had to save the patient's life before we could get the patient back in surgery. He and I had to open up the patient's chest, reach in and put our finger and sew that hole up right there to save that patient's life. So from that point on, so his experience with that problem is what caused his reaction afterwards. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with us. A lot of things that we do is based upon the experiences that we have gone through. Mm-hmm. So yes, there is no experience that does not has an effect on your affect.
Well, I don't want to pry or put words in your mouth, but was the lesson of that experience with Arthur's death, was the lesson, don't put yourself in those kind of situations? Or what was it?
Well, the situation mostly was telling you, do what is right. Follow orders. You were told to keep your butt on the ship. You did not follow orders, and you're paying the consequence. You pay the price for the choice you make. And I'll say this about me. I have never been one who avoided saying that I'm paying the price. I have never been one who look around and make an excuse and say, well, if so-and-so made me do it. I go and look in the mirror first thing, and I say, Bert Maris, what did you do?
I'm curious about those guys that you served with. It's been so long now. How do you think they should be remembered? What was the significance of what you and those other guys did over there?
Well, it was an interesting unit because you only had three men there in the unit outside of the officer, you know, who was white, who had more than a second, third, or fifth grade education. They were from Biloxi, Mississippi, all of that unit except us. Now, my good friend who was from Boston, myself, and this guy, Arthur guy, who was from Chicago, we were the only ones with college education. As a matter of fact, when I found out, I went to the regional commander and I asked him, was it all right if I started classes to teach them? Most of them couldn't even write or read. So they gave me qualifications to teach them basic fundamental subjects, and they would get credit for it back in America. So I started classes, and a number of those guys hated me because of that. They were saying because I had intel, I wanted to make them look stupid. But my attitude was not that. My attitude was to teach them, you know, to help them. But they didn't take that attitude, and one of them who claimed he was a preacher of God, we were chopping down trees and stuff in the swamps, and somebody said, look out. And I turned, and this axe was coming towards my head. He was trying to chop my head off. And I had my axe, and I blocked his. And anyway, at that time, I was really tough and strong. And as a matter of fact, after I beat the heck out of that sucker, and I had him underwater and was going to choke him to death, they saved his life by taking my butt off of him. But he wanted to kill me. But then later on, he come want to invite me to come to services with him. I say, well, I'm going to services. This sucker wanted to kill me. He called himself. But I taught a number of them how to read and write. But in those days, they weren't as strict. They needed fighting men, and they needed men to do certain jobs, and they didn't give a hoot whether you could read, write, or whatever. Just follow the orders. So, yes, those men needed a lot of help, and, you know, I had a lot of things that I still, you know, based upon the kind of background and traditions that I grew up in among my family, that you be productive. You know, I tried even then to be productive. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I painted a lot of watercolor paintings while I was over there, and I mailed them out and stuff. I have no idea where they are. You know, I don't even remember who I mailed them to or anything like that. So I don't know how many paintings I got around anywhere. When President Franklin D. Roosevelt died and Harry Truman took over, I became immediately depressed because here, this president was born in Missouri, a southern area. So there was no way in the world. Now, if I thought, you know, prejudicial things were running bad under Franklin D. Roosevelt, it was certainly going to be worse under Harry Truman. But to my amazement, Harry Truman removed discrimination from the armed force.
He integrated all of them.
That's right. He removed it completely. He did exactly the opposite of what I expected. So that's one of the greatest things that Harry Truman did during his administration.
Well, and he did it. I wasn't alive. I didn't see it. But don't you think one of the reasons he did it is because of what you guys did in the war and what you proved you were capable of, the allegiance and loyalty that you proved, even though you weren't getting everything you deserved here?
Well, I think Harry Truman did it because he had a heart change, personal heart change, and that's why he pushed it and did it. So he saw it was wrong, and he saw that all citizens should be treated exactly the same if they're going to sacrifice their lives for the country. So yes, he made a start for it. But remember, all of this went on, but it was not until you started to get to the times of Martin Luther King and all of those kind of, like I'm demonstrating that big painting in there, that you began to actively begin to change the civil rights situation, you know, little by little. When I got discharged in 1946 and went back to New York City, I went back to finish my last 2 years of college and pre-med, and I graduated in 1948. I applied to École des Beaux-Arts, Université de Paris. École des Beaux-Arts, a school of wonderful arts, and it was the finest art school in the world at the time, and I got accepted. So I was on my way down with a letter saying, yes, I'm coming. And I had the letter. And I remember I was living on 148th Street between Amsterdam and Broadway. And usually I walk down there and 146th Street on that same side of the street is a post office and drop the mail and then go to 145th Street and take the subway down to work. But as I got to the vestibule, I remember I hadn't picked up the mail for yesterday. So I went to the mailbox and opened up the mailbox, and inside the mailbox was a letter from Howard University. So I opened up the letter, and the letter said, you have been accepted to medical school at Howard University. Send a $50 retainer. At this time, you know, blacks at this time would jump 3 feet up in the air and say, Lord, I'm in medical school. Hey! Instead, I took my cap and I banged it on the ground and started cussing and said, God dog, now I got to make a cotton-picking decision. And I said, I'm not going to stress myself over this. And I got a silver half a dollar out of my pocket, and I flipped it. And I said, if it lands head, I'm going to medical school. If it lands tail, I'm going to Paris. And it landed heads. So I went all the way back upstairs, tore up the letter to Paris, wrote a check for $50, put it in the letter and a stamp on it, and mailed it. And I went to medical school on the flip of a coin. That was God working on my butt, not me. Because later I got to be thinking, I said, now, at this time, I hadn't given my heart and soul to Jesus Christ. I'm the only one standing in that vestibule. I said that to myself. Now, why didn't I, since I wanted to go to Paris, when it landed down, heads, I said, oh, it landed just like I wanted, heads for Paris. Mm-hmm. I could easily said that. Why did I keep my oath? It was the Lord working on my butt in spite of me. Because if that hadn't happened, no way in the world would I wound up here in Fresno. No way in the world would I be part of working with Byron Evans in 1958 to start the first open heart surgery here in Fresno. No way in the world would I have, after my wife had divorced me in 1966, would I have met my other wife, Dorothy, and become a Christian. She was part of the influence of me becoming a true Christian and giving myself truly to the Lord and Savior. None of that would have happened. I wouldn't have had my youngest son. None of that. Y'all would be paying big money for dressing up the clothing designed by Fitzalbert Michel Marius.
All the celebrities would be wearing it, right?
That's right. All the celebrities would be wearing it because I would have been the first black designer in the world.
55 years of doing these kind of heart surgeries, and all those patients that you dealt with, the lives that they led after that, the gift of life you're able to give to so many. What are you most proud of when you think back on that medical career? What gives you the most pride or satisfaction?
Well, the most thing that gives me the pride and satisfaction is that I have come to the point that I understand that anything and everything that Bert Marius is able to accomplish, it is because God gave me the ability to do it. All that matters is whether I am doing it according to his will, not according to my own desire. I can't remember the very last time that I had any anxiety about anything. Just like you see me and most people, and they always ask me, says, how come you always got a smile on your face? I said, because I got joy to come from within. I'm not stressed out about nothing. I go to bed every night absolutely peaceful. Without him, none of this is possible. You know, being a poet and stuff, I pray this way. Thank you, Lord, for reminding me I'm birthed from dirt and would be completely inert if it were not for you. I thank the Lord for using me to further his kingdom in spite of my human deficiencies and inefficiencies. that I'm not taking any credit for any of this myself. The only credit I've taken is the fact that I'm willing to submit to his will and be his steward and his messenger.
What a privilege it was to watch as he shared that message wherever he went, as productive and impactful in his final 7 years after retiring at 91 as he was in 55 years as a heart surgeon. So dedicated, so talented, so spirited, so memorable. Dr. Fitzalbert Marius, truly one of a kind. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.